Welcome to At the Table. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is the weekly radio show about all things food, brought to you from Sonoma County, not just wine country, but farm country and cooking country. So today I get to talk to somebody who I've known for a good little while. We're both incredibly young, so it's, you know, since we were children, practically. She is an editor and a director and a cook and she's the keeper of the flame. Welcome to At the Table, the editor of the Good Housekeeping cookbook and the culinary director of Good Housekeeping, the original seal of approval, Susan Westmoreland.
Thank you, Clark.
We have to start right away by saying happy birthday. You don't look a year over 110. Apparently, Good Housekeeping is 125 years old.
No, now it's 133.
Oh my gosh!
I know. It's crazy.
How did Good Housekeeping? We are so looking these days for a seal of approval to know that something is what they say it is, and that it whatever is on the outside of, let's say, a package of food is actually reflective of what's inside. How is Good Housekeeping the kind of progenitor of all that?
You know, Good Housekeeping, it does predate me, started giving out the seal in 1909, and before the Better Business Bureau was anything, before any of these, you know, regulations and regulatory agencies were in place. So they really have advocated for the consumer for over 100 years.
Wow.
The Institute started in 1900, where they did all of the, did and still do all of the product testing. And now there are, you know, we have labs. We actually are starting a new lab this month called the Wellness Lab that's going to do a lot of testing on wellness products, equipment, probably everything from exercise to, who knows about supplements. I'm not sure if that we probably will send all those out for independent stuff if we do that. But we have an electronics lab. We have a beauty and environmental studies lab that does everything from hair color. We have a textiles lab that tests everything from, you know, baby swimmer diapers to backpacks to, you know, bras.
Which is not it's not always a direct line. It just, you know,
And listen, I test for many of the labs because as somebody on site, they do man in the street testing as well as all of the analytics. So as a woman of a certain age, I'm often in the beauty and environmental studies lab because I test a lot of the anti-aging stuff. So it's a really such a fun place to work because you're in everybody else's business a little bit in a really good way. It's very invigorating.
How do we vote for you guys? I mean, I'm thinking that we should just, you know, although that would be dangerous, but that sounds fascinating and wonderful. How did you come to be the culinary director of Good Housekeeping?
I was working at another magazine about 23 years ago.
All right.
I had just 24 years ago, actually. I had just had a baby. My son just turned 24. That's how I know. And I got this call from a headhunter. And Good Housekeeping was like the hallowed walls. I mean, it was and still is the gold standard for a test kitchen and for, you know, all that because it's such an institution that there's always been money to back all of this triple testing and everything that they do. And that's a real luxury, especially these days, as you know, because, you know, we're slashing budgets probably in every business, but particularly in publishing. But back then it was kind of a golden era. And I got this call and my first thought was, oh my God, no, because my boss was an alum of there. And this job came up. You probably remember this woman, Mildred, who had been there for 25 years.
Well, wait a second. Folks, if you don't know, many of the food and food related magazines were run by home economists with real firm grips. In other words, if you were invited to speak at a conference and they had invited you, they would take you by the elbow until you bled. And they were going to actually direct you towards what they had already decided they were going to write about or talk about, right? I mean, there was a real kind of consensus from the top. The agenda, thank you. The agenda had been set. And there was a time when something called the Food Editors Conference really was a way for large food companies and advertisers to, I guess, beat food writers into submission. Let's just be honest and get recipes across the country. But Good Housekeeping wasn't like that because it came from a different tradition, right? I mean, in your case, it wasn't just kind of the feature story about a tomato. It really, the product was the testing and the verification of ingredients, of machines,
the other lab I didn't even mention was we have a whole kitchen appliances and tech lab, which tests everything that touches food. And that's exactly So we're doing the whole 360 on the recipes. We took on gas and electric. Occasionally we touch induction, but most of our readers don't have it yet, so that's not a regular test yet. But it's a fun thing to do, to see what happens in all of these different ways.
Yeah, it's like a living museum of science and industry.
You've seen it.
Oh my gosh, no, I wanted to press every button. You know, I've got the boy thing, right? And I wanted to press a button and hear a whirring sound, possibly grinding. Can people visit your wonderful kitchens? I mean, obviously, unless they're invited, specifically. Can the general public come?
The general public can come once a month on Fridays. We have open tours, and usually two. So people can go on the website and find out and sign up about them if you're in New York. And, give public tours often, but I do occasionally. So if somebody has a group of people they want to bring through, then, you can email me and I would be happy to look into it and help you do it.
All Absolutely. Right. We're talking to Susan Westmoreland. She is the culinary director of Good Housekeeping. She is the editor. She is the whisperer, I guess you'd have to say, of the newest version of a standard bearer, the Good Housekeeping Cookbook. 1,200 triple tested recipes. Now, one of the first things that comes to my mind as I'm holding this book, it looks large enough to hold me, is what's on the cover of it. I think to myself, if this had been the 40s or the 50s, would Meyer lemons, cured olives, jalapenos, chopped parsley, heirloom tomatoes, and coarse salt been on the cover? I mean, it's a timeless book, but it seems to be contemporary.
That's my goal. I looked at so many covers, and I think what you're talking about back then, there probably would have been a melange of finished dishes, a groaning board of brown things.
and possibly some housewifey looking woman with an apron, crisp collar and cuffs, right?
Exactly. So I wanted it to feel timeless, but I wanted it to feel modern. And I think this kind of does it to me. And you probably can tell where my love lies in ingredients. I think the book does a really good job of doing a wide span, and my heart probably will always be in, Italy / the Mediterranean. So,
I do see artichokes, and I see olive oil, and I turn the page and I see whole leaf romaine lettuce, and you know what I mean? There are pots, there are tarts and all those things, and we'll talk more about that. But before we get into the book, how long did it take to do this book? I mean, you had 133
years. Oh, a few years. Like I would say actively from start till now, probably close to three, just because, choosing and organizing and getting a lot of the photos are things that I've done over the past couple of years. So it was just sourcing. Some things were brand new. Some things were looking at an old edition, like for formulas like the pie crust and the classic cakes, and how do we want to tweak those? So it's a lot of pieces, as you can guess.
How many recipes does Good Housekeeping kind of test and publish every month?
It depends. Usually around 30. Wow. The holiday issues can be a lot bigger than that. There's stuff that goes online also. So it's a big equation. Of them are two sentences, and some of them most of them are full on. But when we do some little thing, we'll give you a bunch of variations on how to play with it, which is what I love about this book. I think it's obviously there are 1,200 finished recipes, but it also, if you look in the pantry in the other chapters, it gives you a lot of jumping off points. And that's really what I'm hoping people will get excited about as well as the recipes.
I want people to understand that if you buy a regular cookbook, there can be, usually there has to be at least 100 recipes. So 3 months of your magazine or just November, December, right, is a cookbook. Right, and you're doing this.
That's right. Yeah.
And you're doing this year in and year out. How many people are in that kitchen?
You're making me talk.
I know, exactly. You need something to eat. I have a wonderful recipe. How many people do you have in that kitchen whipping up, these thousands of pumpkin latte formats?
On a given day, it can be anywhere from 3 to 5 full on. So it's a busy place.
All right. What I want people to do before we get really into the book, and we're going to get into the book in just 2 minutes, but in this first little conversation with Susan Westmoreland, who is the director of all things culinary and a couple of things that go whir and buzz at Good Housekeeping, and she is the editor, cat herder, I guess, of the Good Housekeeping Cookbook, 1,200 triple tested recipes. That's just out. But Susan, so a typical day, we've got a minute and 10 seconds, a typical day in the Good Housekeeping Test Kitchen, let's say while you're working on this wonderful book.
So while I'm working on the book, I'm probably, you know, at my computer more, but it's come in, see everybody, have a coffee. I mean, it's a very congenial atmosphere. So you're doing that, and then you're, you know, I might be sitting there working, and then somebody will say, tasting, and you'll go over and you'll see what, you know, what's out, and everybody has a taste, makes comments, notes are taken. If something isn't working, and it seems like it can be working, the notes will be, you know, change this and change this, and then it will get tested again, probably not that day, perhaps the next day, perhaps. So we move on, more writing, more tasting, more, you know, people coming by. Good Housekeeping is a very public place, so our advertisers are always...
They're always walking in the front door and wondering...
And the thing is, you have to, in 2 seconds, it's all glass, so there's an outer hallway,
yes.
And then there's an inner hallway, so even if you're walking by, the test kitchen is a fishbowl.
And the fish is delicious. All right, when we come back with Susan Westmoreland, we're going to be talking a whole lot about very, very good housekeeping right here at the table. We are back. I'm Clark Wolf, and this is At the Table with Good Housekeeping Cookbook editor, the woman who put together 1,200 triple-tested recipes, Susan Westmoreland. Susan, I like at the beginning of the book, it says, getting started. Since you've picked up this book, we'll assume you want to cook. Well,
it's my wicked sense of humor.
It is your sense of humor. I got that right. I just started giggling because, you know, the number one and two places that people read cookbooks, right?
Where?
Okay.
the bathroom? No.
Yes. Yes. The bedroom and the bathroom. And number three is usually by the pool, but it's only number three because, you know, not everybody has a pool. But there's a lot about this that's very accessible, that's very useful, that I want to give to every millennial, although it's more than they'll carry. Right? You start with getting started and really kind of organizing the kitchen, and you're thinking about it, right? The setup. Talk to us.
Exactly. So I think, you know, without sounding critical, I think at this point, a lot of people are not cooking on a regular basis.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, if you want to overstate it, we can say there's culinary illiteracy. But I think that, you know, there are websites and lots of great videos that show you these amazing overhead do-do-do-do-do-do-do things. But if you don't have a background, you're not going to really get there.
Yeah.
So this was kind of my take on, like, if you want to dive in, you can dip your toe and you can look at, like, the three things you need the most, or you can look at how you might want to outfit your kitchen if, you know, somebody gave you this when you got married or when you're, you know, moving into your first apartment. Or, you know, if you're a serious cook, there's just lots and lots of great recipes and information because sometimes you forget stuff.
Well, I love this. When it talks about pots and pans, and really that is the crux of it, right? A lot of kids move into their first apartment and they've got one frying pan and one saucepan, and that's it. Here you talk about stovetop starts, nice but not necessary. I love that. And ovenware and really how this all works, and then kind of tips for how to look at different pans and how to use them, how to choose a knife. Yes. People, you know, get these expensive things, or young people today, everybody actually, you know, when you go to a restaurant, you want something that's homey. And when you cook at home, mm-hmm. you want it to feel professional. And that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's true. I kind of love that. Yes.
Right. It's a juxtaposition. So you want to have a really expensive knife. I mean, you bought these $9 eggs at the farmer's market and you have a piece of 4-year-old aged Parmesan and you don't really have a grater or a knife. Or a spatula, right? You don't even know what to do. So, as you were organizing this, did you discover things that you had forgotten about how important it is? I mean, things that you take for granted?
I have a brownstone, so my kitchen is fantastic, but it is small.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a galley, but it's so I'm very, very organized, and I have everything I need. And I mean, I think I'm always like, okay, but there are things that, you know, I have in my basement because I can't fit them.
Yeah.
And I think, how often do I go downstairs to get that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I think that nice but not necessary is kind of my basement.
I love that. Well, and the truth is, if you want to get somebody with an organized kitchen, call a New Yorker. Right. I mean,
exactly. Yeah, right. But, well, you know, but on the other hand, like I could not live without my microplane. I don't know why, but it's just become like an indispensable tool for me. And yeah. I don't have anything to do on a paid basis with them. I just love their stuff.
On a paid basis.
You talk about it so much. Really? Do you work for them? No, I don't.
No, I don't. I swear to God. You heard it here, folks. All right. Susan Westmoreland, Good Housekeeping. Food safety and storage. Thank you very much. I was living with somebody who had grown up in Texas, and so chicken fried cornflakes were the norm. And when I was cohabitating at first, there was this desire to learn about food, right? And I knew mm-hmm. about it, but the other person did not. And I suddenly started seeing this really litany of truly dangerous activity. I mean, raw chicken on the wood board, followed by salad making? No. So this food safety and storage section is really important, isn't it?
It really is. And I think, you know, now more than ever, we have very smart bacteria who know how to multiply and scare us and do bad things. I know that there's a huge ground beef recall right now, like millions of pounds, which is just like, but I mean, I remember my first food safety horror was at my future mother-in-law's house.
There you go. That's the place to do it. If you're going to get food poisoning, it should be from your future mother-in-law, because then you can hold it over her head forever, right?
And there was a ham, you know, she's a southerner, and you know, it was after dinner, and she just put like a kitchen towel over the ham, and we were going to go to bed. And I said, do you want me to bring that to another refrigerator? She said, no, we'll just leave it out.
Yeah.
And so that was one thing, but then there were other things that also got left out, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, but this, and you know, my mother-in-law now is almost 92, and she's fabulous, and she hasn't had, I don't know if she's ever had food poisoning.
She's given food poisoning. You know, she's one of those people. Yeah. I don't get food poisoning. I give food. No.
I mean, she is one of the most amazing women that I will ever know. She's incredible, and she actually is a really good cook. But there were just things like, you know, you didn't keep eggs in the refrigerator. Just, you know, things from another era where. Maybe, you know, bacteria wasn't such a major part of life, but...
Well, I want to... For example, eggs in the refrigerator. I mean, folks, if you don't know, if you buy eggs at the farmer's market, sometimes you can leave them out because they have not been washed the way industrial eggs are washed, and that protects the inside of the egg is
still
gone.
On it.
Yeah, it's still on it, exactly. So, I mean, I now buy eggs from a farmer, and I do rinse them. He brushes them off, you know, because, you know, chicken poop just really doesn't have the flavor it used to. But, these are things where if you don't know why, and Americans have come to this ridiculous notion that food can be safe in some way if it's processed. And we've found out in the last few years that, I mean, cornflakes, it's a breakfast cereal, had to be recalled because it had E. coli. Another one had, you know, I mean, just because food is processed or made or sold by a big company does not mean, there's no way to make food 100% safe. I mean, because
there's not. I mean, we're learning that monthly, practically, you know, with produce recalls and meat recalls and something packaged like cereal. I mean, really? You think that should be completely inert and fine, but no, it's not.
Well, first of all, we don't want inert food, because if it's inert, it's probably got less or no nutritional value. I mean, if you eat the box, if you eat the box that the cereal comes in, you might be fine. Plenty of roughage. You know what I mean? But I mean, people don't understand that. And there are key things. In this last few years, people have discovered that people thought that you could get sick from dairy and from beef and from fish, but they discovered that if lettuce isn't handled properly, you know what I mean?
And cantaloupe.
You know, that was heartbreaking to me. I mean, in New York, Jersey, a few years ago in New Jersey, eggs over easy were illegal because there was so much salmonella. Now, they fixed that. Or they changed the situation. But, I mean, I don't want to belabor this. This is a huge, wonderful, glorious book. I don't want to scare people. But taking a moment, I mean, you're going to spend all this time on your phone looking for the perfect knife. You're going to spend $85 on a knife, and then you're going to poison yourself because you don't know the basics of food safety, right?
Because you cut into the cantaloupe skin without rinsing it first. Yeah, no, exactly. I think it's really important. It's... And it's, I mean, it's just, I tried to break everything down really simply. So it's nice and graphic. It's 5 rules of food safety, some for at home and some for on the road.
Which I love, like, which I, yeah, absolutely. And then you go to Eating Well and you take that nutritional label from the back of packages and you actually annotate it very, very simply.
That's what I really, you know, it's like, because you look at all these things, and it can be intimidating. And I think, I'm a label reader, so I'm like, I love this. I love what it means. But it's changed a little bit, and I thought it would be really good to have it be big. It's a whole page of just the label with the call-outs of what they mean.
All right, but in our last minute of this segment, and we just have a minute in this segment, you go from these very, very practical things, and before you even get into the recipes proper, as it were, you talk about entertaining. I love that because you're really going to what it is. I mean, you're getting people motivated for what really moves them towards cooking, right?
I hope so. I mean, I grew up around a table, basically. I come from a very strong Italian-American family where life centered around the table. And I think, you know, you learn a lot about people. I think it's the best place to learn about your kids. It's the best place to be with friends. And, you know, being in a restaurant is fantastic, but entertaining at home is on a totally different level. And I think just warmer and more intimate. And I just want to encourage people to do that and have it be demystified.
All right.
Well, you know, it's not hard.
When we come back, we're going to jump into the pantry with Susan Westmoreland. I've never known of an Italian family that wasn't strong, but entertaining is, and the table is where we want to be. Come right back. We're back at the table. I'm Clark Wolf. I'm here with Susan Westmoreland. We're talking about the new book that she has helped marshal because a lot of people involved and a lot of tomatoes. It's called The Good Housekeeping Cookbook, 1,200 triple tested recipes. Now, Susan, we've been spending a lot of time at the front of the book, and I'm going to spend a little bit more time before we get into the recipes. We're talking about pantry basics. Tell me.
I believe most of us cook, at least start in the pantry every night if we're cooking.
Right.
And to me, you know, having a well-stocked pantry with everything from, you know, the essentials of, you know, delicious, you know, jarred, put-up roasted peppers that you may have done or something that you buy is important. But then I think that there are a lot of things that you can make and have as a pantry staple. And you'll see that there's a lot of that here. I had some visitors from Italy last week, and I made from the book. The book had just come. The advanced copies came late, so I had just gotten it, and I made our version of Nutella.
Oh,
and they were,
whoa.
They were, so I thought, should I have done this or not? But it's a really great recipe. I think we call it Choco Nut Spread.
Yes. So it's not to be sued, right?
I got this thank you note saying that the Nutella was stupendo.
You know, it's funny. I spent a birthday a few years ago in a pizzeria in New York City. It's called Don Antonio. And I was there I was there with a few friends, and I know Roberto, who's the pizziolo and the owner. And they mentioned to him that it was my birthday, and out came a 2-layer pizza in the center of which and on top of which was, you know, 8 pounds of Nutella. It was one lone candle melting. All right. One of my favorite parts of this entire gorgeous book is page 47. How long will it last? It is one of those questions. I wish now I know.
I wrote that down to talk about. Isn't that great? I'm glad you said that.
This is a page 47 question, right? go for it. Tell me why you did this. And I'm so glad you did.
I think we're all like, you know, you buy, you know, milk has a date on it. And then, you know, what is it? What do sell by dates? What do use by dates mean? But also, like, you buy some smoked salmon. It's like, oh, you know, I open a can of anchovies. How long do these things really last?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you'll see something that, you know, you open bacon and it will say it's good until, you know, 3 months from now. But then once you open it, how long does it last?
Right.
Not till that date, only about a week.
Only about, you've got to tell people the realities of these foods that they're, and you talk about how much time they can stay in the freezer.
Exactly. And so that's another misnomer because people think, oh, if I stick it in the freezer, but like cured products like pork do not do well in the freezer. You can't keep them there for a year. Like a month or so is really optimum.
And part of the reason for that is because they have been cured, they have been salted, they have been seasoned. And those things, even in a frozen situation, continue to have an impact, don't they?
They do. They do. So it's just, Things deteriorate. Is it going to kill you? No. Things deteriorate. The texture deteriorates. The flavor deteriorates. And it's not going to give you the same product that you're thinking you're going to get.
Well, all right. And that's kind of what this is about. In some cases, it's about safety. And in other cases, it's about taste and texture and all those other things. And breaking all of that down is kind of beyond the pale. What you really want to do when you're cooking at home is have good ingredients at least the higher portion of their quality, right? Certainly safety, but they should be in the good flavor zone and the good texture zone. So
right. And that means, you know, not on this chart, but in another part of the book, when you buy green vegetables, you don't want to keep a head of broccoli in the refrigerator for a week. Yeah, it's probably going to be okay, but, you know, you want to use it in the first, you know, 2 or 3 days because that's when it's fresh. That's when it has most of its vitamins. And you'll, you know, if you touch that stem and twist it and it's a little bit flabby, that's not optimum broccoli.
That is not my new t-shirt is going to be optimum broccoli. Actually, it sounds like a vegetal punk rock group, right?
And exactly. Now,
never mind, optimum broccoli. I love that so much. Well, all right, here's one. This is an example of the kind of thing that I love about this book, homemade ricotta cheese. I mean, it's one of those things where you know it's kind of simple and you know it's probably easy to do, but you want to make sure somebody tells you exactly how to do it so that it comes out pleasant and also that you don't poison yourself and others, potential mothers-in-law. But also, you then offer a few different little variations. I mean, ricotta cheese is one of those things that used to be in home kitchens all the time, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I did this a few Easters ago with my son and his best friend. We were having a lot of people for Easter, and I said, I want to make ricotta with you guys to serve as an appetizer. And they were like, oh, really? Well, yeah. They were so excited.
I mean, yeah. Well, there is something magical about making something that you could actually call cheese, right?
I mean, exactly. And they were, you know, at the time, they were like, you know, 10, I think. It was really, you know, it was just one of those things where we talk about it, we've done it since, but that the first time they were very young and just thought it was just awesome.
Well, it is awesome.
And
I don't care if you're 30, right?
If you buy your milk at the farmer's market and, you know, you use delicious whole milk, that it's just, it's so good. It's so good. I was just in Sicily where it's also so good.
All right. So where in the book are tickets to Sicily? Let me look in here.
Yes,
what
exactly.
Section is it? All right. So now you're going in and you're talking about these different sauces and you show pesto and you show peach and honey jam, which I think is a wonderful thing. And, lots of appetizers.
Cherry tomato confit is what I also want to bring up because it's something that I do a lot. It's on page 64. And it's basically all you're doing is roasting tomatoes on a sheet pan. And you can keep them in a jar in the refrigerator literally for a couple of weeks. But you can also, I mean, I use them with that delicious ricotta on a crostini. I also just toss them with some pasta or put them simply on bread or just serve them with some hard cheese. It's one of those things that you can do anything with it, and it's just this pop of incredible flavor. And if you get them at the farmer's market in those pints that are multicolored, it's just this gorgeous thing that takes you about 5 minutes of active prep time.
You know, cherry tomatoes are one of those secret weapons to cooks everywhere, right? Because
exactly.
In the process of the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, when tomatoes in America were being bred more and more for shipping and for shelf life,
tomatoes, I believe they were called.
They were called slicing tomatoes. When I ate one, I wanted to slice my wrist. They messed with it and in the process, they managed to take out a lot of the flavor by mistake. But by mistake, because scientists are humans too, they forgot to do that, or they failed to do that, or they missed doing that with cherry tomatoes. So cherry tomatoes, even if they're conventionally grown, wash them, folks, really have a lot more flavor than slicing tomatoes or a lot of others. And they are a secret ingredient for a lot of good things. All right. You really, oh my goodness, holiday champagne punch and ice ring, Irish coffee, frozen margarita.
Okay, we're drinking now. Okay, sorry.
Now we're drinking. Now, listen, we have less than a minute in this segment, but to sum up, you did a section on cocktails.
We did. You know, cocktails are, you want to be that, you know, that hold of the moment / timeless. But cocktails are having a major moment,
yep,
I think, on every coast and in the middle. And our readers entertain at home a lot, and I just thought it would be fun to include some cocktails to go with some of these, you know, nibbles.
Well, what I love about this is that, you know, you have a Manhattan and it's got the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. but that's only the first one, folks. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk. We're going to get right into the poultry of the matter, and we're going to be talking to Susan Westmoreland some more about the glorious, I mean, it's not called that, but I'm calling it that, Good Housekeeping Cookbook, 1,200 triple-tested recipes, right back here at the table. That's my favorite intro music. I just have to tell you, I'm Clark Wolf. We're back here at the table with Susan Westmoreland. She is the editor of Good Housekeeping Cookbook, 1,200 triple-tested recipes. It's out now. Get it and make a small miniature house out of it. I mean, it's 5. how many pounds is this?
I believe it's 5.87.
Yeah, so how long in a 250-degree oven? No, I'm kidding. All right, so we've been spending a lot of time at the front of the book because, quite frankly, folks, if you spent a little bit of extra time just reading the first 100 pages, you've gone to cooking school. I mean, you've gotten so much that you...
Oh, thank you, Clark.
I mean, no, it's really useful. It's really straightforward. It's organized well and thoughtfully. Now, all right, here come the chapters. Meat, poultry, seafood, vegetarian and grains, and I really hate that poor vegetarian keeps getting cooked, and pasta, grilling, I love this, pasta, grilling, vegetables, salads. I think it's so cool because those are the ways that you've really determined Americans think about food and about cooking. And then breakfast and brunch, breads, pizzas and sandwiches, cookies and bars, cakes, pies, and other desserts. And many people would like to start on cakes, pies. And, yeah, exactly. Turn to page,
I'm one of those people.
Right. Turn to page 621 and sing along, right? So
yeah, exactly.
Let's talk first about meat, poultry, and seafood. How have you made those timeless and classic?
Well, I think, you know, there's really simple ways in the... I was looking at one of the recipe that I make a bunch of times, and it's just a seared flank with a red onion marmalade. And it's just like a really simple recipe. Doesn't take a lot of time. Great for weeknight. But then, you know, you've got the full-on, you know, beef braises and the holiday roasts and all of that stuff. So we want to keep some of the classics in there because I feel like people are going to go to this book when it's like, oh, God, how do you make that? But also, I really wanted to have a lot of focus on things that you can do in your life when you just want a really delicious recipe, but you don't want to spend more than a half an hour, 45 minutes doing prep on it.
Because you don't have time. Yeah, I mean,
because you don't have time. I mean, yeah. We're hearing that more and more from our readers. And the other thing that we're hearing, which I love, is about 10 years ago, I remember talking to my editor and saying, you know, I think we just need to, like, when we do our weeknight recipes, I want to start putting vegetarian options in there because I really think that readers are eating more that way, and we're trying to encourage them. We're on the Meatless Monday bandwagon, and we started doing it, and we got so much positive feedback that I really wanted to have ways into that. So in the salad chapter, you'll find a lot of main dish salads.
Yeah.
You know, in the vegetarian and grain chapter, you're going to find just delicious things that are, you know, I want that. It's not like, oh, I should eat vegetarian. It's like, I want to eat that. And I love being able to do that. But I do think people, you know, when they're browsing, they're not going to go through the whole chicken and meat and other chapters to find a grill recipe. They want a grill.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know.
Well, it's very sensible. And, you know, people should know that the percentage of people who define themselves as vegan or vegetarian has not moved in 30 years.
I think people have occasions when they eat that way, but they are not full on.
That's right.
You know, that's my reader. That's the people that I, you know, feel like I'm talking to all the time. They really appreciate it. They enjoy it. They're not trying to change their entire life to be a vegan or their family's life.
Exactly. By the same token, it's estimated that something like 58% of Americans actually now eat more fruits and vegetables than they did before. I mean, so...
Which I love.
And I do too. And because there are farmers markets, because there's so much more focus on the outside of the grocery store. And by the way, I've turned to page 402 and 3. It has its own zip code. It's really rather a large couple of places.
402-13, okay.
Exactly. Okay. And there are a couple of things that just jump out at me. Miso glazed salmon is really kind of a modern restaurant-derived sensibility. And then Cajun shrimp also kind of come... I mean, how much of this comes out of popular culture, do you think? And I realize that this
so much, because I think... You know, people are eating out more. The world has become really, I mean, like, not to be trite, but the world has really become a global village. And the nice news for us is that, you know, supermarkets and small markets are now carrying things from other ethnic pantries that make weeknight cooking so delicious and so easy. I mean, miso paste is like a just glorious thing, especially if you throw a little bit of ginger in there. And it's got a little bit of sweet. It's got a little bit of salt. It's delicious. And you can just, like, literally paint it on and roast or grill. And, you know, the salad is, now you can buy edamame that are frozen and already shelled. And it's just a really simple salad that goes with it that's got a little bit of a, you know, a hint of Japanese flavors, and it's really, really nice.
Well, one of the things I like is that, you said it, it's that Global Village thing. There was a time when the New York restaurant and home cooking scene was called a melting pot, but I don't think that is true anymore. I really think it's a crossroads, right? You really now do get all the flavors as they're meant to be brought to your table. Now, I've got to take a minute or so to talk about eggs. I mean, you have such glorious presentations of eggs because for a while we weren't supposed to eat them. Then we are supposed to eat them. We're not supposed
to. I love eggs.
Eggs are all over everything, right? I want an egg on top of.
And I get mine at the farmer's market too. And it's just like, I just love eggs. So, yes.
Why'd you do that? Why did you do that? And I mean, besides the fact that you love it, I mean, it is incredibly versatile. It is incredibly quick, right?
They're so versatile. They're an incredible source of, you know, easy protein.
Right.
The value of them, whether you're spending $9 or $4, is still, and it's incredible. I mean, and they're just, as you say, they could be a canvas for anything from, like, you know, an easy strata to these. If you look in the appetizer chapter, I just kind of went a little crazy on the deviled egg thing because I really love them.
You went crazy. Excuse me. Ladies and gentlemen, Susan Westmoreland has been committed to the hospital for
eating too many deviled eggs.
That's why they call them deviled. No, they're popular everywhere. And, you know, my new book, They're Never Wrong. All right. When we come back, our last little segment is going to be all about sweetness and good housekeeping right here at the table. We're back at the table for our last few minutes with Susan Westmoreland and this glorious book, Good Housekeeping Cookbook, 1200 Triple Tested Recipes. Susan, first, website.
goodhousekeeping.com.
Gee, that's straightforward. And then the other thing is, how do they interact with you and with the book? And I mean, obviously, the book is available wherever books are sold, your independent bookstore down the road and online and all that other stuff. But how do people, can they interact with you?
Absolutely, yes. On the Good Housekeeping Facebook thing, I'm there all the time. And also, I have a video series called Test Kitchen Secrets, where I am in front of the camera talking and teaching a lot of basics, which is really fun. And I get comments a lot, and I'm always happy to answer. So check me out there.
And she has a really good pair of glasses. I mean, you know, it's really striking. It's a great. She's got a great look for video. Susan, in our last few minutes, sweet things, and also if you really, we're going to say to these to anyone thinking about buying this book, you know, what are the top reasons to get it, and where do I get gingerbread ones? I know, page 609.
I think the reason to buy the book is because it will take you through anything, no matter where you are in your cooking life, and I think it's a really fun read. I think it's fun to pick up. I don't know how many hundred photographs there are, but they're great. And I think, you know, I have a wicked sweet tooth, so I'm just going to say I have never met a pound cake that I don't love. So
yeah. You'll
find a million variations of butter cakes in here. Mm. And on page 617, there's something called salted caramel bark,
which
I make for about every you know, gift or hostess thing that I go to. And it's, you can do it with any nut you want. And it's basically you retoast toasted nuts with sugar, and then you pour dark chocolate all over them and break them into.
Oh my God. Yeah. See, folks, this is retoasting, not regifting, because once this is given away, they will be,
you know, it's super easy to do, and it's always a wow. So I think that's, you know, like there's simple stuff like that, which, like, I don't know. I love having delicious little simple things, as well as, you know, full on the berry pavlova with the lemon curd, which I do make a lot. But, you know, there's many multiple levels and ways in a delicious biscuit. Good Housekeeping, famous for its popovers. That recipe is
yes.
in here, and it's
yes.
100 and plus years old, and it still is delivering great popovers.
How many times has this book or this, you know, kind of collection come from Good Housekeeping? I'm guessing that this is an long history.
The first one, which I fell in love with when I got there, it was 1903.
All right.
So it took them a while.
All right.
And it's a very narrow thing. And then about every between 6 and 10 years, depending on what was going on and in the food world and in the editorial world. This is, I think, our first one in about 8 or 9 years for sure. And this is the first one that I really have gotten to do a total gut reno on, and you'll see visually it's very, very different from the other ones.
It's also
and it's a lot more livelier and interactive, which is colorful.
Yeah, it's lively, it's colorful, it's surrounded by glass, and it was brought to us by not just Good Housekeeping, by good Susan Westmoreland. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a blast.
Absolutely. Thanks for this great book, and thanks for coming to us right here at the table.